the death does appear to be a homicide, so we're treating it like it is. So we're taking the necessary investigative steps.
Troopers investigate the death of a 13-year-old girl in Cake. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 7th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Fairbanks residents testify to save the F-16 squadron at Eielson Air Force Base.
The 17 facilities recommended for demolition have a plant replacement value of $156 million.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Alaska State Troopers are investigating the death of a 13-year-old girl in the small southeast community of Cake as a homicide. Family members have identified the girl as 13-year-old Mackenzie Howard of Cake. Alaska State Troopers say the girl was found by a member of the community just after 11:30 Tuesday night inside the Arctic entryway to the Memorial Presbyterian Church. Trooper spokesperson Beth Ipson says investigators are continuing to work in Cake today.
The death does appear to be a homicide, so we're treating it like it is. So we're taking the necessary investigative steps, collecting evidence, talking to people, and we're treating it like it is a homicide. It's a matter of getting the confirmation from the state medical examiner's office. They'll be conducting an autopsy and determining the cause of death.
Howard's body is being sent to Anchorage for autopsy. Ipson could not say when the autopsy would happen. No arrests have been made in the case, but Ipson says investigators are working hard to follow up on leads in the small community.
Pretty much any community is going to be shaken up by the death of a 13-year-old girl. And then, you know, then when it's determined that it appears to be a homicide, it causes even more ripples. And we do have a lot of information coming in, but there's a lot of information that there's a lot of, I hate to call them rumors, but there's a lot of information that kind of gets twisted around. And we have to track down these leads.
A number of visitors were in Cake this week for a memorial service for Tlingit Elder Clarence Jackson. Mackenzie Howard turned 13 less than a month ago. She was looking forward to the day when she could play high school basketball. As it turns out, basketball runs in her family. Both her parents play the game, and her dad, Kip Howard, is a regular in Southeast Alaska's annual gold medal tournament. He says his daughter wanted to follow in their footsteps.
She says, "Mom, you're a baller. And my dad's a baller. So that must mean I'm going to be a super baller." And that was a joy to hear from her.
Howard says the outpouring of support from the community since Mackenzie's death has been overwhelming. Howard says he and his family have a lot of unanswered questions about what happened to Mackenzie, but he also says he's trying to focus on good memories of the girl who wanted one day to play basketball at Baylor University.
I called her downstairs one day while I was watching the women's basketball because I wanted her to see this tall girl, because in my eyes, that's how my daughter was going to be. She was going to be a 6'5 center that could really tear up the court. She would come home from open gym saying, "Dad, I own the court tonight," with a big old smile on her face.
That's Kip Howard reflecting on his 13-year-old daughter. Mackenzie Howard's body was found Tuesday night in the southeast community of Cake. The Air Force is wrapping up a series of public meetings in Alaska tonight in North Pole. The scoping sessions are to identify issues to consider in an environmental impact statement for the proposed downsizing of Eielson Air Force Base. The cost savings of moving an F-16 squadron from Fairbanks to Anchorage have faced a range of opposition and questions at meetings in both communities. KUAC's Dan Bross reports on a scoping session yesterday in Fairbanks.
Air Force officials were greeted by a sea of red shirts, symbolic of the local campaign to protect Eielson, but the meeting atmosphere was very civil. The Air Force laid out its plan to downsize Eielson. Pacific Air Force Representative Brigadier General Patrick Malachowski says the proposed movement of Eielson's F-16 squadron to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in 2014 would save money through staffing reductions and other efficiencies.
Move approximately 623 personnel from Eielson Air Force Base down to JBAIR, a total of which 542 will arrive and operate out of JBAIR. And through efficiencies with major base operations and support, we would lose or eliminate 81 personnel in 2014. And the savings, the cost projected savings on that in 2014 is approximately $14.6 million.
General Malachowski says an additional 730 personnel would be cut or moved from Eielson over the following 2 years, realizing another $227 million in cost savings over 5 years. The estimates were challenged by people who testified at Wednesday's scoping meeting in Fairbanks, including University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor Brian Rogers, who was a consultant for the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation during a previous attempt to downsize Eielson in 2005.
I can tell you that the prior process underestimated economic impact to the region, underestimated costs and overestimated benefits, and I urge you to look closely at those numbers.
Specific to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Chancellor Rogers pointed to the projected loss of $2.5 million in annual tuition from Air Force personnel and the resulting elimination of 80 course offerings and at least 35 university jobs. Fairbanks City Mayor Jerry Cleworth attacked another aspect of the Eielson downsizing, the proposed demolition of buildings.
The 17 facilities recommended for demolition have a plant replacement value of $156 million. Nowhere in the CTAF report is this loss of a capital assets used to offset any desired gains. A serious oversight.
Cleworth also questioned demolition cost estimates and the ability of the Air Force to maintain remaining Eielson infrastructure in warm status for annual training exercises and still save money. A number of other politicians also raised issues with the move, including Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich, who phoned in comments from Washington, D.C., saying the Air Force is bucking congressional direction by moving ahead on the Eielson restructure. State Senator John Coghill of North Pole said the Eielson downsizing proposal hurts in a community that strongly supported the military.
It's a kick in the chest, and I'm not, there's no desire to threaten, but it has a long-term impact on that support base. I think it'll erode. So I think you need to quantify that somehow.
Coghill also urged the Air Force to consider the value of Eielson's location next to extensive military training areas, an attribute along with Alaska's strategic location in the world, drummed on by several speakers. Alaska Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs Tom Katkis suggested the Air Force scrap the downsizing in favor of relocating resources from a base in Germany to bolster Eielson.
Consider options that involve moving additional force structure to this great state and capitalized on our unmatched opportunities.
Among other issues raised in scoping meeting testimony were impacts on a National Guard air refueling wing that would remain at Eielson and the risk of basing all Alaska Air Force resources at one facility, in a state where volcanic eruptions and earthquakes can impact operations. The Air Force will take issues raised at the Alaska sessions and through comments received by March 1st into consideration in anticipation of completion of the EIS and a final decision on the Eielson downsizing this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Oral arguments were heard this morning in federal district court in Anchorage on a challenge to a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wetlands permit. The case centers on whether or not federal agencies have complied with Clean Water Act requirements for wetlands protection measures in approving the proposed Port McKenzie Railroad spur. Plaintiffs Cook Inlet Keeper and other environmental groups have challenged the wetlands permit, which allows the railroad to fill 95 acres of wetlands between Port McKenzie and Houston. Trustees for Alaska attorney Brian Littmans argued that the railroad's plan to elevate the spur line's tracks in essence creates a 35-mile-long dike, which can cause irreparable harm to both migrating salmon and to adjacent wetlands beyond the railroad corridor. Federal defense attorney Kenneth Rooney told the court that the Corps' hydrology assessments concluded that construction would not interrupt water flow outside of a certain area because water flows vertically in wetlands, not horizontally. Attorneys on both sides have declined comment on pending litigation, but borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan said one point stood out.
The plaintiffs are arguing that the railroad is a dam or a dike, but our attorney is saying, well, I've never seen a dam that has 8 bridges, many culverts, allowing the movement of water.
Bob Shavelson, speaking for Cook Inlet Keepers, says plaintiffs want to ensure that the railroad expansion won't result in harm.
Because there's no law against thoughtless government spending on massive projects that will destroy our wild salmon habitat.
The plaintiffs are seeking an injunction that will temporarily halt work on the railroad spur. In November of last year, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed an earlier decision to stop work on the initial phases of the project. In September, the Corps announced that it had issued a wetlands permit for the railroad project under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. The permit requires the borough to purchase wetlands areas to compensate for any impacts to wetlands posed by rail spur construction. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Lance Mackey scratches from the Yukon Quest.
Apparently, I'm going to have as many bad years in a row now as I had good years in a row.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This coming May, the Arctic Council will meet in Sweden to finalize an international agreement on oil spill preparedness. In the meantime, questions are multiplying about the adequacy of existing oil spill response technology to deal with Arctic conditions. And one of the primary tools, dispersants, are coming under attack from the marine conservation organization Oceana in a scientific report that was released this week in Anchorage at the Alaska Forum on the Environment. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Back in 2001, chemist Jeff Short at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's laboratory in Auk Bay, Alaska, tried to make some crude oil break up with the dispersant Corexit, and it didn't work very well. Short became convinced that it would work even less well out in the real world.
I'm not a big, if it works in the lab, it must work in the field guy. I don't like those arguments. I like to see evidence from the field that shows that it worked in the field.
Short is now retired from NOAA, and Oceana has contracted him to study how dispersants would work in the Arctic. His test more than 10 years ago was fairly simple. You put the oil in a flask, add whatever dispersant, and shake it up and measure it under different conditions. Under the best of conditions, the dispersants could break up about a quarter of the oil. In Arctic temperatures, not so much.
At optimal temperature, they only dispersed about 25% of the oil. And then as the temperature declined, it got successively worse, so that by 3 degrees C, it didn't disperse at all.
Short remains highly critical of dispersants today. And in the report, he basically lists all the factors that might keep them from working in the Arctic. There are a lot of them beyond temperature. There are only certain weather conditions under which dispersants work, and that includes not only wind, but fog. The spill has to be visible, reachable, and a large supply of the dispersant needs to be nearby, a possible problem because the number of airstrips that can handle shipments of it are limited in Arctic Alaska. And if it doesn't arrive quickly, there's no point in using it.
On a surface spill, you only got 1 to 2 days.
Short was among many experts called down to the Gulf of Mexico to consult on the Deepwater Horizon spill. That incident is thought by many to be a real dispersant success story. Tons of Corexit were pumped into the plume escaping from the blowout, and there's convincing chemical evidence that a huge amount of that oil biodegraded, in part because it was broken up into tiny droplets. But Short thinks the oil was actually being broken up by natural gas coming up from the well. And at a science conference last year, microbial ecologist Terry Hazen of the Lawrence Berkeley Lab backed that up, at least in part.
Did the droplets form because of the Corexit? No, not totally. Without the Corexit, they would have formed anyway because the oil was being jetted into the deep subsurface, and those droplets were forming anyway. Did the Corexit make more droplets? Maybe. Well, the jury's still out on that.
Federal officials in charge of the response still disagree about how effective dispersants were in the Deepwater Horizon incident. When they published their lessons learned in a special edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science last December, they concluded that the dispersants were somewhat successful. But in his report, Jeff Short questions that.
Well, yes, I am very critical of it. It seems absurd to me as a scientist to conclude from two diametrically opposed camps that somehow truth lies in the middle and we'll just take the average and we'll make that policy. That's nuts.
The paper's primary author, former NOAA head Jane Lubchenco, stands by the government decision to use the dispersants on the plume.
It was our judgment that use of dispersants would help the oil be naturally biodegraded more rapidly, and that certainly seems to have been the case.
The Environmental Protection Agency continues to consider a petition filed late last year by ecologist Ricky Ott, a number of Alaska Native activists, and Jeff Short for severe limitations on future dispersant use. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A piece of legislation that would roll back discharge regulations on cruise ships could appear on the Senate floor as early as next week. It's already passed in the House, and today the Senate Finance Committee invited the public to comment on it. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The testimony lasted for more than 2 hours, even though the committee had planned to meet for only 90 minutes. And for the most part, the people who spoke expressed concern that the cruise ship wastewater bill could damage the marine environment. Here's Bernard Richard, a resident of Anchorage.
I guess I'm a little bit perplexed right now that we would risk changing the perception of purity and environmental beauty.
The bill he's talking about would scrap a requirement that cruise ships meet stricter water standards by 2016. Under a rule put in place by a 2006 Citizens Initiative, vessels would eventually have to make sure they're not releasing an excess of ammonia or copper at the point of discharge. This bill would let them release waste into mixing zones instead, like ferries or municipal treatment plants. Advocates of the bill say it's unfair for cruise ships to be held to a different standard, and they say that cruise ships are already using advanced wastewater treatment technology. John Binkley is the president of the Alaska Cruise Association and spoke in support of the bill.
The ballot initiative moved the bar to a different level that was unattainable.
Binkley cited a report issued by a state panel of engineers, scientists, and fishing and cruise industry representatives that there wasn't evidence to prove that further technological upgrades would provide significant environmental benefit. But critics of the bill took issue with that statement. Chip Toma was invited to testify on behalf of Alaskans for Responsible Cruising, and he says that most of the cruise fleet is already complying with the stricter discharge requirements.
It's not impossible because we're meeting them.
Questions were also raised about the impact that copper levels have on salmon health and migration. Senator Anna Fairclough, a Republican from Eagle River, asked that the Department of Fish and Game weigh in on the bill before it moves to the Senate floor.
We've heard several people testify with concerns about subsistence fishing and habitat. And I know that Fish and Game is in endeavoring to start some research specific on king salmon runs and how our fish are moving in and out of the streams.
In a follow-up interview, Fairclough said that getting Fish and Game's input shouldn't have an effect on the speed at which the bill moves through the committee. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation has previously stated that they would like to see action on the bill by February 15th, so they can begin work on their discharge permits. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Since 2010, the Alaska State Legislature has debated the passage of a Stand Your Ground law. versions of the bill have made their way through committee, passed in the House, and then ultimately stalled in the Senate. Now the bill is back. Sponsor Mark Newman, a Republican representative from Big Lake, introduced it to the House Judiciary Committee yesterday and explained that it expands what's known as the Castle Doctrine. Right now, if a person is in their home or business, that person is justified in using deadly force in self-defense, even if he or she could theoretically retreat.
HB 24 clarifies that right exists not only in our home, but also in any place that we have a right to be.
Basically any place a person isn't trespassing. Stand Your Ground laws are on the books in 24 states, and Florida's version was the subject of national controversy after Trayvon Martin, an unarmed teenager, was fatally shot by neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman. Representatives from the Alaska State Troopers and the Alaska Public Defender Agency answered questions about HB 24 but did not speak in favor of the bill or against it. Previously, the Alaska Department of Law has registered concerns over Stand Your Ground legislation, stating that it could authorize vigilantism. None of the people who testified registered opposition to the bill during the first hearing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. And by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A Yukon Quest dog on Jake Berkowitz's team has died. Quest officials say the dog, named General, was being transported to Whitehorse by a race veterinarian at the time of death. A necropsy will be conducted to determine the cause of death. Also today, a demoralized and disappointed Lance Mackey pulled his dog team into Dawson and scratched from the Yukon Quest.
Apparently, I'm going to have as many bad years in a row now as I had good years in a row.
Mackey has finished the Quest 6 times with 4 wins. He's been working with a new group of dogs over the last 2 seasons. He says he can't explain why the team quit eating and drinking early on in the race. He immediately dropped 4 dogs in Carmax, the race's second checkpoint, and his team continued to dwindle from there.
You know, and I pride myself on the way they look. So if they don't look to me like I want them to look, I'm going to leave them. And damn it. Leaving 4 at a time is a hard thing to do, but it was the best thing. And I don't know, and I wish I had the answers.
Mackey says it's only the 4th time in his career that he has scratched from a race. He has no plans for retiring, but Mackey says it could be a while before he signs up for another Quest.
I can only get beat down so many times before I got to take a little breather here.
Mackey plans to enjoy a little respite in Dawson City before he heads back to Fairbanks to regroup and get his team ready for the Iditarod next month. Hugh Neff and Alan Moore are leading the Quest, but 3 teams rounding out a group of frontrunners are confident they can make up the time on the trail. KYC's Emily Schwing reports.
2 years ago, Brent Sass drove his team into Eagle with a dramatic story about a rescue on top of American Summit. But a reroute of the trail this year eliminates the climb. The 6-time Quest finisher is at his best driving dogs over tough trail and in poor weather, but Sass doesn't mind this year's change.
Those are definitely the places where I feel like I can make up time. They're also places where I can lose time if someone's up there and needs help. I mean, I definitely lost some time helping Hans Gott out that year. So, another 50 miles of cruising on the river, it might be good for us as well.
The reroute could also help Jake Berkowitz gain time up front. He's a mixed team of veterans and young dogs. He says he's working on rounding out the youngsters for a long mushing career.
Our goal isn't to win the Quest this year. Our goal is to win the Quest for the next 10 years, or Iditarod for the next 10 years, and getting those 2-year-olds here in good fashion is what's going to do that for us.
Rookie Scott Smith says his dogs are already primed for the Alaskan side of the trail. 7 of them finished 4th in last year's Iditarod. Smith is considered this year's dark horse.
Shh, be very, very quiet. We are hunting mushes.
Smith admits to a few rookie mistakes that could keep him from making up the time he needs.
just not being as efficient as they could, you know. And that's cost us a little bit of time here and there. And when I say efficient, just my stop time on the trail. I need to work on that, you know, because for every minute that you're stopped on the trail, it's not only the minute that you've been stopped on the trail, but it's a minute that you're not moving down the trail. So it's like 2 minutes, you know.
But Smith could get lucky. The first few teams will break trail through fresh snow into Alaska. There are still 500 miles of trail, notorious for sub-zero temperatures, dangerous overflow, and overall poor conditions. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Dawson City, I'm Emily Schwing.
After a few quiet months, Cleveland Volcano is waking up. Cleveland's last recorded eruption was in November. Then, at the end of January, the Alaska Volcano Observatory satellites picked up warming temperatures on Cleveland's surface. And they found a new lava dome growing in the summit crater. It's 330 feet in diameter, just shy of a football field. Chris Way-Thomas is a geologist with the AVO and the United States Geological Survey. He says Cleveland periodically grows lava domes only to have them explode a few months later.
You know, if there's enough gas and water vapor that builds up, the dome itself could be exploded out. Part of that explosion would produce some fine ash, but other parts of it would send large chunks of rock, block-sized chunks of rock, out of the crater onto the flanks of the upper part of the volcano.
Because of that risk, the AVO has raised the aviation alert level around Cleveland to orange. Theoretically, the volcano could produce an ash plume extending as high as 20,000 feet into the atmosphere, which would disrupt commercial air traffic. But Way-Thomas says that isn't likely. Cleveland's last lava dome exploded in the spring of 2012. And finally tonight, a correction. In a story that aired yesterday about Title 21, we said that Friday, February 8th, was the deadline for all amendments to Title 21 to be turned into the Anchorage Assembly. That date is actually February 12th. The Assembly plans to take their final vote on Title 21 on February 26th. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Emily Schwing from the Yukon Quest Trail, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.